So at a higher level, on a national level, is there any way to make the minority-owned banks have more of a voice or more of an impact in a larger scale than just one city or one county?
I did not foresee this question. That would be helpful. I think the challenge with that, just to be honest, is that those banks are small. So are we asking, I liken that to having a strong diversity, equity, inclusion, culture, and conversation within your organization, and then asking the Black man to always speak and to always explain. It's like putting the burden. So there's that. There's also the resources that currently exist within those banks and that system. You're not going to have the system-wide change without the bigger banks participating
right.
in the change.
I think participation is critical, but at the same time, partnership is missing. You know, based on my limited understanding of the banking system, which I admit I'm no expert, but based on my observation, bankers work together. Bankers kind of have a network where they pass business and help each other, loan each other money. So could there not be space for partnership between these regional and citywide minority-owned banks and the big players? Because there's a couple, I think I know of maybe two Black-owned banks that have, you know, an online presence. So I live in Virginia. One is based in Florida, but I can still go online and sign up for an account and get loans and things of that nature. I know that, you know, a lot of large businesses team up with small businesses for contracting. Even for federal contracting, these big players will team up with a small Black-owned business or Native American-owned business to get a federal contract. Is there no space for larger banks to partner with smaller banks to help get the money flowing? And
there are some. So I'll give a couple of examples. So we have a partner in the space that we work, and it's a specific program with a specific intention, but the partner is a black owned bank in a large East Coast city. That's what I'll say. And we have just our little subsidiary of the subsidiary of the organization. We have made deposits into that bank that, while not huge, were substantial for that bank. We have made grants to that bank, and we have made market or slightly below market rate loans to that bank. So that does actually happen between the big banks and the smaller banks, but it has to be done at such a different scale and with such different intention to actually see the changes. So I think it does happen, but what is the intention of our organization or other large commercial banks? There's an article, we haven't talked about this, but it came out in the last couple of, probably last month, all of the investing that went on in Detroit. One of the largest banks led a lot of that effort, along with these community-focused financial institutions that are not technically commercial banks, but lend and invest. And hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars have been invested in Detroit in the last decade. The percentage that has gone to people of color is like 12% in Detroit. So you're bringing a city, it's hyperbole, but you're bringing a city back to life by investing dollars. But you're doing it by investing in the same people who have the resources and could be working anywhere. But now, because of the value kind of proposition in Detroit, are working in Detroit and is that investment, is that, and I don't know if 12% is a number, 17%. It is something like below 20% going to people of color in a city like Detroit. So all of that well-intended effort is unintentionally continuing to enrich the white people who probably have good intentions for Detroit, but you're not making any change to the wealth gap. You're leaving an entire population behind. And also in their, not defense, but to their credit, those financial institutions have been doing the data collection and trying to understand their impact and have said publicly, we did this and it's not having the effect that we want to have. Like this is not how you should, if you want to change the dynamics that have lasted for decades here, you have to change the way you invest. And we did not do that. We've invested hundreds of millions of dollars exactly the way that got us here. And so what do we do and how do we change it? And they create things. And this is happening in several cities around the country. This is an investment funding, an equity investment funding tool for entrepreneurs of color, specifically in Detroit, in Chicago, in Philadelphia. You're seeing those types of funds and investment tools pop up being created by these types of organizations. And that's the type of movement that we're seeing.
That's a very familiar scenario for me. I've worked in the federal space for over a decade. And I won't just say it's only affecting the federal space, but I think that when you have these policies that are generated, even it may be goodwill, good intention, and maybe not, but on the surface, and maybe even truly it could be with good intentions. But again, when it comes back to equity, if you don't have members from various communities at the table when these policies are being written up, you're very much less likely to get the desired result, because if you only have one point of view at the table when the policy has been written, you don't have any other voices that could say, well, hey, maybe this will happen or maybe that'll happen. I said that to say it relates to what I see, because we have the minority-owned business contracting things here in D.C. Who is the number one beneficiary of those things? White women, right. But it's not even white women, it's white men. I've worked for at least three companies that were white women owned. Two of them, I never saw the woman that owned the company.
The white woman that
showed up. It was always the husband at every meeting telling us, you know, all the corporate. The only time you saw the wife was at the Christmas party. So, yeah, it's a white woman-owned company or a woman-owned company, but it's really just a married couple. The husband is still running the show.
But put her name on the...
Right. So that, to me, is akin to kind of what might be happening in this type of space, where the policies might look good on the surface, but who's in line to take advantage because of how the policy is worded or written? A lot of times these policies are written based on the knowledge of the person writing it or based on the influence of a third party who's telling that person this is what should be in that policy. So if I'm a fat cat with $1 million in the bank and I can influence how this policy is going to go down, I'm going to say, hey, let's make it say this. And it on the surface, it looks good. But really, in the meat and potatoes, if you don't have $1 million in the bank, you're not going to get a foot in the door.
Never happens.
So it's, you know, how, you know, if even if I'm an investor, right, I have friends of mine who are investors. They may have access to $1 or $2 million. But if you need $15 million to get your foot in the door, there's still a huge gap. But the policy reads perfect. The policy reads like, hey, this is going to...
You can access it. Right. But that, I think the distinction I would make is there's always going to be a loophole. There's always going to be a program that can be a bit manipulated. There's always going to be a person willing to do it, no matter what it looks like. And the question becomes, and the only real change happens when people and organizations understand the problem that exists, understands the harm that it does to them and them personally, them as an organization, and us all as a society, and is willing to hand over, give something up, hand over their resources. You're laughing.
That's the key.
But that's actually the key. That's the only way you change that, the root problem.
Right.
And a lot of these organizations go in with good intentions, but at the end of the day, and I think what I and my colleagues and the people I know and work with, we all suffer from a little bit, is if you really get into this and really start thinking about it, you recognize my salary, my benefits, the attorneys that I use, the accountants that we pay, all the auxiliary work that happens and how much of the programmatic benefit goes to us versus the low-income people. We won't even talk about race at that point, just low-income people, of which there are way too many in this country. How much of those benefits go to us versus them? And does our participation in the programs, this is the Band-Aid versus cure question, is it actually making the situation better, or is it just furthering the divide? And well, how do you make decisions that are different?
Well, I mean, I understand that, but at the same time, I think the Band-Aid versus cure is a level higher, because if you didn't have people doing the jobs that are being done, then there would be no access to these programs to a lot of people. So I think the Band-Aid versus cure needs to be up.
Oh, I totally agree with you.
One
I'm just
level
saying
higher.
I got a role in it, right?
Right, right.
So does everyone else who's involved in it. And where I talk to my bosses, very profit focused, although we are in a business line that is, and working with a tool that's intended to be community benefit focused. And to me, the decision is binary of, and this is not even kind of changing investing habits or doing anything different. This is just outright pricing and profitability. If I pay another penny, the profitability for the bank goes down. The community benefits another penny's worth, but the benefit or the profitability for the bank goes down. So should we not at every turn be trying to increase the profitability for the bank, because ultimately the bank's goal is to increase shareholder value. And that is the most basic part of this. Let's say we're willing to split the difference or give 75% to the community, to the low-income community in which we're investing. Are we then also willing to do the work to ensure that it goes to the people who truly do not have access and who truly need a focus to change that wealth divide, to actually have an impact on the centuries and decades. We talk about it, and it, there are times where it's really depressing because it's just like, how would you ever undo that level of damage? So it's profitability, but it's intention. And then it's the action that says, I'm going to give up something that I have so that this person whose life has been affected at every turn from the day they were born to this moment by intentional, systemic, institutionalized racism, and that that is ruining both my life as a white woman and their life as a person of color. Sorry, what? How do you make that decision? Yeah. Who makes that decision?
That level of sacrifice, back to an earlier point, you know, no one wants to take a pay cut.
Right.
No one wants to lose their job.
Right.
So there has to be a balance, you know, but, and again, that's kind of where I go back to at a higher level, the overall, the sum needs to be a positive number, right? At the end of the day, if the number is positive as far as helping people in the community, community investment, equity, it's better than where it is if that organization had not existed or if nothing had been done, period. But not to say that that's where things should be, but if the ball is being pushed forward.
But we've had a lot of the, and I know you're not saying that the programs that are in place are perfect.
But at all.
But we've had a lot of these programs in place for decades, years and decades. And the disparity has grown during that time. It is not getting better from the tools and programs and resources that exist today.
So yeah, that was something that I think we kind of briefly mentioned earlier. It might've been before we started recording, but it comes back to knowledge and tools and programs. A lot of these programs existed, but did people have access or knowledge? You know, if a program exists, but again, due to the system that's in place, people aren't given access to it, or people are ignorant of it, then that program's effectiveness is not going to reflect what it should. So just like the whole redlining issue, people didn't know that was going on, or the masses didn't know it was going on until 20 years later when we saw the statistics, and we saw the effects of it. But at the time in the 70s and the 80s, we just knew that we got declined for a loan. We didn't know that 12 other people on the same street also got declined,
right,
or that the real estate agent wasn't showing the properties in that area. So, you know, history is going to really show the truth. But where we are today,
I think it's already showing us the truth, right?
Well, yeah, the past is showing us the truth of what has happened and what's happening now. But where we're going to go with the current policy in the next 2, 5, 10 years.
But how do you get the average person, the average legislator, the average business person to believe that the outcomes are caused by this, again, institutionalized systemic decision-making that not just caused you not to get that loan, but also 12 other people who look like you not to get that loan, while the white guy with the same financial history details living half a mile away got the loan.
I think if you don't look at the facts and the data that exist and come to that conclusion, you don't want to come to that conclusion. You want to ignore those facts. You want the system to stay the same because it's to your advantage. It's to your children's advantage. You don't want to help those other people because you have some deniability that, you know, you can either find some little fact that's inaccurate and say, oh, that's all trash. Or you can just say, hey, the policy passed in 1977 and it's working. And you just kind of brush all that stuff under the rug.
You blame, you deny the history, and you blame the individual, when at this point in our evolution as a society, a lot of times the individual goes back to the outcome being determined by where you're born and what color you are. Where you're born and what color you are in this society creates tremendous hurdles from day one. And if I, as a decision maker, whether I'm a common, just a regular guy, I'm a bank lender, I'm a legislator, I believe that your failures aren't those significant hurdles. So you're getting up every day, you're trying to jump the hurdles and getting knocked back, where I'm getting a step over my hurdles, but I can point to you and say, the problem is you just didn't try very hard. We see the ills in that community, and it's all personal decision. Then it's easy to deny the facts that are otherwise very obvious. And that's where we get in trouble. People don't change. People don't want to. And I don't know which comes first, the chicken or the egg. Do you want to deny the facts because it feels better to blame the individual? Or are you afraid if you do anything different, you're giving up your own resource?
I think it definitely comes to giving up your own resources. I think protectionism is a huge thing. People are definitely trying to protect what they feel is theirs. They're trying to protect their children's and their family members' financial security. You know, this whole build the wall thing, you know. All of this is like a false sense of security.
But money's real security, right? Yeah, and I mean,
money is real security, but at the same time, one, the more people that are in the country, the more opportunity you have to make money from them, sell them something, provide them a service. That's one thing. Second, most immigrants that come here are taking jobs that you and your children will never imagine wanting to do or do yourself. I don't know anyone. You know, I'm a black man. I still don't know anyone who wants to go pick fruit and vegetables in the field or put
for
a 60 roof on
miles
a, house.
A day or whatever.
Right. I mean, we barely want to cut our own grass. So that's all the farce. I mean,
right.
You know, and if they do come here and get a decent paying job, that's more tax money. Then that means I can go sell them a shirt. I can go sell them some shoes. I can sell them a car. So the more people that are here, it's the more opportunity to make money. Shouldn't be a problem. These are not people coming here to be homeless and poor. They're coming here to make money. They're coming here to build wealth.
But then we talked about this, that's the identity politics of, and this has existed throughout I am not a historian, and I don't like, but through history, there have been racially based politics that created the space for the diversion of resources from one group to another.